Good morning. Welcome to our meeting. It's 9 a.m. on January 21st, 2025. And time to convene a regular meeting of the Snohomish County PD Board of Commissioners. I am Sid Logan, President of the Commission. Joining me today are Commissioner Tony Olson, our Vice President, Commissioner Julieta Alperona Crosby, our Secretary, John Harlow, our CEO, Colin Wolfrock, our Chief Legal Officer, Allison Morrison, Clerk of the Board, Jenny Rich and Morgan Stolzner, Deputy Clerk of the Board. Please mute or turn off your cell phones or electronic devices at this time. Copies of the agenda are located on the deputy clerk's table near the entrance. Are there any items to be added or changes to be made to the published agenda, commissioners?
I have none.
Okay. Comments from the public is item one on the agenda, and that's when the board will hear comments for items that are not listed on today's agenda. Comments will be limited to 5 minutes, and persons shall be recognized to speak from the sign-up card located on the deputy clerk's table near the entrance. If joining by Zoom, click raise hand or dial star 9 by phone. I will call on you to speak at the appropriate time. If you're calling in on a phone, dial star 6 to unmute. This meeting is being recorded. When addressing the board during the meeting, please step up to the podium, use the microphone, state and spell your name, and indicate where you're from. Please remain at the podium while you speak and address the commissioner, not the audience. If documents or other materials to enter into the record, please hand them to the deputy clerk who will distribute them to the board. We appreciate your cooperation with our procedures. Please note that all motions receive an automatic silent second from the board. This ensures that all issues can be brought to the floor for inspection. So we'll begin with the flag salute. I pledge allegiance to the flag.
Indivisible,
liberty, and justice for all. Okay, next on our agenda is item one, comments from the public. Are there any comments from the public on items not on today's agenda? Do you have a hand raised, Justin? We have Gayla Shoemake online. Good morning, Gayla. Go ahead.
Good morning, commissioners. It's good to see you all there today. I just want to compliment you on things that you've been doing in the past, particularly the good work for the when we had the great wind a couple of weeks ago. I didn't get a chance to tell you what how proud I was of you. And I'm looking forward to seeing the IRG coming up. And there are, I know we have a lot going on with trying to figure out what the needs are going to be and how we're going to be able to address them as electricity becomes more and more needed and our water continues to decrease. So I'm looking forward to that, and I will be commenting on that after I see the new plan. So keep up the good work, and I'll be right here.
Thank you for your comments. Next, we have David Barber. Mr. Barber, you have 5 minutes. Go ahead. Mr. Barber, are you muted?
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can. Good morning.
Great. Thanks for the opportunity to speak. My name is David Barber. I'm from Linwood, Washington, and my comment is for Julieta. Julieta, I want to take a moment to say thank you for your service to Linwood and that you will be missed. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments, Mr. Barber. We'll know that our hands up. We'll move to item two, our consent agenda. We have 2A, approval of the minutes for the regular meeting of January 7th, 2025. 2B, bid awards, professional service contract and amendments. And 2C, consideration of certification, slash ratification, and approval of district checks and vouchers. I'll call for a motion.
I move approval.
Are there any comments from the public regarding the consent agenda? I don't see any hand. Commissioners, do you have any questions or comments about the consent agenda items?
I have none.
None either. I will call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries unanimously. Next, we have updates. We have Ryan Collins here to provide legislative update. Good morning, Ryan.
Good morning.
Aren't you in the wrong city?
I'll be a little bit later today.
Good morning, commissioners. For the record, I'm Ryan Collins, the District State Government and External Affairs Specialist 3, and I'm here to present our key legislation report covering the first week of the 2025 session. The purpose of this presentation is to report on legislation we've identified as key state legislation for the commission. While I've left time at the end of the presentation for any questions, please feel free to jump in at any time. Today, January 21st, marks day 9 of the 105-day legislative session. If you've been following any of the headlines, there are two major themes that have dominated the first week. The challenges facing lawmakers over the budget being one, and two, the new faces in leadership, primarily Bob Ferguson as our new governor. Beyond the headlines, lawmakers have been busy introducing bills this session in the first wave. As of today, only a week and 2 days after the start of session, we've recorded over 1,000 bills have been introduced thus far. Government relations reviewed each of those bills and identified 104 that we will monitor throughout the rest of session. Today, we will focus on four of those that we have identified as key legislation for commission engagement. We believe these bills could be the most impactful, could be on a trajectory for potential passage, or are likely to be discussed in the communities that you serve. This is a dynamic list that will evolve over time as we continue to monitor legislation to remove the key cutoff dates shown on slide 3. While there are four bills I will discuss with the board today, you can expect some of these may drop off, while new ones may be introduced in forthcoming reports. As you can see, only nine days into session, and we're still pretty early on in terms of legislative action. I will note that one of the four bills we're tracking has already received a public hearing, while two more are scheduled for hearings this week. We expect that we will also expect a lot of this to change as things start picking up speed. Looking forward, an important point for the commission is the first cutoff date, which is in 31 days. This is the last day a bill must pass out of the House or Senate policy committees in the chamber where the bill was introduced. I highlight this date because it's really the last day we see any meaningful bill introductions. Between now and then, we are anticipating another 1,000 to 1,500 bills to be introduced. So without further ado, the first bill we will be reporting on is SB 5088, which would authorize counties to impose a privileged tax above the 3% on a utility's gross income derived within the county's unincorporated areas. The tax would apply to all types of utility services, including water, electricity, broadband, sewage, and waste. For context, utilities currently pay several privileged taxes already to both state and several municipalities within the county. Cities can tax up to 6%, while the state has varying tax rates depending upon the service. For example, the tax on electricity is 3.8% and just over 5% for water at the state level. Operation.
That's what's in the bill?
No, that's current law. The bill would allow counties the option to expand upon those taxes. Operationally, the bill would allow Snohomish and Island counties, the councils, the option to apply the privilege tax to all our customers within the boundaries of their jurisdictions, and then would also apply a tax credit for the municipalities that already implemented a privilege tax. As with other privilege taxes, the bill acknowledges that this tax would be passed directly through to customers and stipulates that the tax must be added as a separate line item on customers' bills. The bill was referred to the House Local Government Committee and was scheduled for a hearing last week, but was pulled before consideration. We are currently still reviewing the bill and will continue to monitor it, reporting back to the commission as the session progresses. We did want to flag this bill, particularly given the concerns over local control, since privilege taxes do influence the financial decisions the board does make.
Understand how this tax would interact with the city tax. So say if my city tax is 6% and my county levies a 3%, how does that work?
So in essence, the county's tax, if you were paying, so say you're in, just going to use Everett as an example, and Everett is taxing you at 6% of the privilege tax, the utility would receive a credit for the county tax of 3% for the within the city borders of Everett, if that makes sense. So it negates the county tax for the city.
So does the customer pay the 6 plus the 3?
Correct, yes.
Huh. I'm surprised. I thought when I read it, it meant that,
sorry, excuse me.
City, you pay
the city, if you're a customer within the city, you're only paying a 6%.
Okay.
The utility would be covered. So the 3% only applies to unincorporated components of the
county. Okay, that makes sense.
I have a question. If this bill passed, how...
Your microphone is a little closer. Thank you.
If the bill passed, how the county going to distribute this money to the cities?
That's a really good question. I don't want to speak on behalf of the county and what they would potentially do with the revenue they've raised from this. There has been ongoing conversations at the state level that the county has been, they're looking for revenue sources comparable to what the cities are doing. That said, I don't want to speak for them, so I don't fully know. That said, again, we would be taxed for any of the unincorporated areas. Our customers in unincorporated areas of the county, and we would get a tax credit for all the residents within the cities themselves that charge a similar tax.
And I'm just curious, who is leading this bill?
It's Senator Chapman, who represents, he's, I believe, located in Port Angeles, but represents parts of the Olympic Peninsula.
Does any representative or senator the are for our county who represents us there?
That is a very good question. I'll have to double check on the sponsorship. I don't believe so off the top of my head, but I can double check for you.
I say that because sometimes the bills they start and they implement and they try to pass, but they cannot generalize. Every county is different. So that's the reason I'm curious to see if any representative or senator they are part of our county. They are part of that, I mean, for that information. So.
Absolutely. No, it's a great question, and I'll follow up. I will say again, not to speculate too much, but when a bill is pulled from committee hearing before consideration, it's not necessarily the best indication of passage, but we'll continue to monitor.
Thank you.
Of course.
Request to go back.
I guess I was surprised, having lived in a city, you know, always paying 6%. I was surprised that the unincorporated residents didn't pay anything. I don't really understand what the 6% is for other than its revenue.
Correct.
Sort of. I'm sort of surprised this is 3%, not 6%.
It's been an ongoing conversation at the state level amongst the cities and counties, and the counties particularly have been interested in finding other revenue sources. And this being for them low hanging fruit. That said, as you can probably imagine, utilities are not as as excited about it.
Okay, now I remember the request was to see if there's any in our delegation that are co-signers of the bill. Are we in agreement that we'd be open to hearing about that?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I made a note. In our previous formats, and I'm thinking, well, that particular issue, we did receive information on sponsors. And then what I don't see here, and maybe it's because we haven't moved far enough into the session, implications specifically for Snowbud.
That is correct. In previous formats, we did have the sponsors of the bill listed. We had taken them off as they had not been we found them not to be particularly useful for board consideration, but we can certainly make amends.
Yes. Commissioner Crosby seemed to feel that that was important. And I do support that. Sure. And I also support my second point.
Sure.
For me, it brings it home when I know the impact on snow.
Absolutely. And again, we'll include sponsors going forward. And for this one, we again wanted to specify that there are certainly concerns with local control related
local
to
control.
Or the PUD.
Not my interest on that one.
Absolutely. All right. Hearing no more questions, we'll move to the next bill, which is HB 1253, which clarifies and expands how consumer-owned utilities may engage in joint use or limited liability company agreements. Specifically, the bill adds language clarifying that Washington utilities can engage in agreements with non-Washington regulated entities, which applies to all out-of-state electricity generation agreements. It also updates the provisions language to include renewable energy facilities, storage and transmission facilities as project options for joint use agreements. Bill also expands the type of entities that utilities may enter into agreements with, including non-utility entities and individuals. The bill was introduced at the request of Seattle City Light, which has been working with lawmakers to advance the proposal. The bill received a public hearing in the House Environment and Energy Committee on January 16th. As drafted, Snohomish PUD staff believe the change is a good and narrow fix that should provide more flexibility in the types of agreements Washington utilities can engage in, particularly as we look forward to future generation sources to meet load growth. We signed in support of the bill on January 16th, and we'll continue to engage with Seattle and other stakeholders, such as the Washington Public Utility District Association, also known as WPUDA, who are supporting the legislation as it moves through the process, and we'll keep the commission updated. Next is HB 1237, which would modify the approval process of the Energy Facility Site Evaluation Council, also known as EFSEC. As context, the Energy Facility Site Evaluation Council is a state organization that oversees the siting, permitting, and compliance of environmental laws for major energy facilities in the state. Its mission is to provide a streamlined process for the siting of large-scale clean energy projects. The bill is the next iteration of legislative efforts over the past several years aimed at making the state's siting and permitting process more efficient by improving the siting council's approval process. The bill inserts specific criteria that would bind when the council recommends governor approval of a site. These criteria include whether a site provides public benefits, such as reduced emissions, helping meet the state's climate strategy, or promoting the sale of non-emitting energy. As drafted, sites and projects would also be required to show improvements to public and environmental health, as well as provide economic benefits resulting from reduced emissions. Finally, the bill would limit when the siting council is required to hold a public hearing ahead of a recommendation to the governor to only when the council has determined that a site does not comply with existing environmental, zoning, or health requirements. PUD staff are still reviewing this bill. We have not engaged in the Energy Facility Site Evaluation Council process before, which is a mostly voluntary process depending upon the project. Since the process is already permissive for projects the PUD would likely pursue, these changes are unlikely to impact current PUD operations and decisions. However, the bill would likely enable more certainty and predictability in the siting process for third-party developers and developers of major clean energy projects. Since submitting this report, the bill actually received a public hearing in the House Energy and Environment Committee yesterday and is scheduled for a hearing in the Senate, their Senate counterpart this afternoon.
Kind of the local control, but not ours per se.
Correct. It's this is Representative Fitzgibbons' bill. He's been this is again, I think, the third, fourth bill he's introduced to try to kind of fix or tinker with the EFSEC process. Again, the intention of the bill is to streamline siting and permitting, but that the devil's very much in the details.
Yeah.
Finally, is HB 1329. Which is a bill that clarifies the energy purchased under long-term contracts with Bonneville Power Administration, also known as BPA, is excluded from the no coal provision under the Clean Energy Transformation Act. It clarifies long-term contracts under BPA and it excludes particularly long-term preference contracts from the no coal provision under the Clean Energy Transformation Act, unless the contract is sources coal directly. The bill is a priority in the power generation pool of which the PUD is a member. As context, the Clean Energy Transformation Act is the primary climate law that for the electric utility and has three major provisions: the 80-20 2035 target, the 100% clean 2045 target, and then the no coal provision, which goes into effect at the end of this year. There's concern that the current language in the no coal provision is too uncertain regarding BPA's preference customer contracts, specifically saying long-term preference contracts include unspecified power, and BPA can't always determine the exact source of the generated electrons. This uncertainty combined with the contract length might conflict with the no coal provisions language, potentially leading to some significant penalties for BPA customers. The bill would ensure that those contracts are excluded from being considered a coal-fired resource unless they are explicitly tied to include coal. Beyond the Bonneville fix, the bill also alters the requirements of the contract length for unspecified wholesale power purchase contracts. The PUD staff thinks these changes are an important fix because they would remove statutory uncertainty around our preference contracts with Bonneville as the Clean Energy Transformation Act's provisions go into effect this year. The bill is scheduled for a public hearing this week in the House Energy and Environment Committee, and we're currently working with other stakeholders on the best method to lend our support during the hearing this week, as well as the bill moves forward in the process. And with that, I'll see if there's any other additional questions.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I know that it might be too early to ask, but do we know how the federal policy regarding national energy impact will be impact our current renewable energy?
That is a great question. Okay. And I'm looking over to Kim for the federal side.
I know it's too much to digest and everything, but
Kim Johnston, I'm the Chief Government Relations Strategy Officer. It's a great question, and I just don't have answers yet. I think we saw yesterday President Trump issued a number of executive orders. Clearly, energy policy is a top priority for him. How that ends up trickling down in policy and practical terms, and how those policies interplay with state policies remains to be seen. It's something that I will be paying close attention to in weeks and months.
Commissioner, thank you for bringing that up. Actually, I stayed up most of the night reading some of the executive orders that may or may not relate to our business. And my conclusion is it's going to end up in the courts for a long, long time.
Yeah, I think very
incorrect assumption.
No, I think executive orders sometimes can be messaging vehicles. Sometimes they create new policy, and where they do create new policy, there's always potential for things to land in the courts. And so there will be assessments of what presidential powers are appropriate and where they might extend beyond that.
I guess federal law.
We have seen already today.
How sad is that? I stayed up all night reading that stuff.
Can you share with me?
Maybe somewhere else in all those executive orders, but one can introduce new power resources, but if you haven't got the bulk grid to transfer it to, for consumer use, I didn't see anything related to how you get it there. So interesting.
There were a lot of
national transmission shortfall.
A lot of questions. But what is clear is that energy is the top priority for President Trump and his administration. And so we'll be hearing a lot more about that, and we'll be monitoring that closely coming weeks, months, years.
I was concerned about, I was thinking about our smart meters for people with factories in Mexico, and I'm wondering if a tariff somehow that cost could be put onto us, and we already have a contract, but the contract probably did not anticipate tariffs.
Yeah, trade and tariff policies are another top priority for the President Trump's and his administration. I think, I know I had worked with Scott Jones for the last few months to see if we couldn't get a better handle on where our supply chain comes from on various things, just so we could potentially understand the impacts as new policies are rolled out. But yes, I do expect trade and policy in the next 100 days.
That's the main times. Any other questions for Ryan or Ken? We have any more updates, Tom?
Yes.
Thank you, Ryan.
Thanks, Ryan. Great job. Jason Duskowski is going to give us an update on how we fared over the last few days in the extra cold weather and compared to last year.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Okay.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. No big surprises. Easy conversation. I'm Jason Ziskowski. I'm our Chief Energy Resource Officer. Morning, Commissioners. Good to see you. So first off, you know, the cold weather this past weekend wasn't anything like what we saw last weekend with the, or last year with the highs kind of coming up into the 40s, not staying down in the freezing, and the low temperatures, you know, a fair amount warmer than last year. So we also had a lot more slice availability. So last year we were capped at about 7,400 megawatt hours on a daily basis. And this year we had up near 12,000. So yeah, significant amount more of slice availability there. And we did use that. We also added 2% to the load forecast that we were seeing. So we were conservative on the load forecast there. You know, and we also removed even wind generation from the forecast. We did get a little bit of wind, not very much. I think our total nameplate capacity we have in our contract is about 167 megawatts, and we, on an hourly basis, maybe got about 10. So not a ton. We didn't get a lot last year either. And that's kind of typical when you get a cold front come in and that pressure system sitting over the region. We have revised our energy risk management targets that we bring into the month. That's both energy and capacity, and we've, you know, raised those, and so that really helped us out. We had all that coming into the weekend. I will say, you know, the market did not go crazy at all. I think prices were anywhere from $80 to, you know, $100, so they weren't or anything near the price gap there. We carried our length. We ramped up Jackson to about its maximum output, and it's still there. It'll come down today, and Scott will come up and talk about the reservoir there. We did purchase a little bit of energy in advance, 50 megawatts balance a month for light load hours. That was to help us out Sunday, and then a little bit on Monday and Tuesday, but that was all done coming into the week. And those prices were pretty low. So where did loads finish? Pretty close to forecast on a daily basis, about 400 megawatt hours difference. Total load for the day was around 27,000 megawatt hours. Last year it was up near 32 to 35,000, so it's a little bit higher. Our peak load was yesterday morning, I think the 8 or 9 o'clock hour. And that was 1344. Last year we were at 1403. That was the peak, yeah. And that was our all-time highest peak in megawatts there. Let's see, anything else here? I mentioned the real-time prices. Oh, another good thing. We didn't buy any power in real time this weekend. So we sold a little bit. You know, prices were pretty much the same from where we purchased it. So not a big difference there.
That's a good thing.
Great. Yeah, great. Super proud of the team. Ryan, the power scheduling team, Mike, everyone who, you know, planned for the weekend. So did a nice job.
Well, it's a huge difference in the amount of slice.
It is. Yeah, totally different position on the slice this year. So that was a good thing. Maybe I'll have Scott.
I wonder if it's about.
Yeah.
The picture hasn't been as pretty sometimes.
Yeah, it certainly wasn't last year. Any more questions just in general on the weekend? Any more questions?
No, I don't. I want to say thank you for your work.
Yeah. Absolutely. All right, Scott.
Yeah, thanks, Jason. Scott Spahr, I manage generation engineering for the PD. Thanks, Jason, and following up on Commissioner Logan's question, and I agree, it's a big difference 12 months ago, you know, from an MLK weekend to this one that we had. Keep in mind, in 23 and 24, those water years were both poor hydro years, and this current year, very average in terms of the forecast. So kind of a return to mean. Regionally, since July to end of December, our precipitation is 97% of our long-term average. So return to average, the intriguing part of it is that our snowpack, at least locally, in our basin is more the 65 to 80% average. So we've seen more water come as liquid water than as snowpack. What we're doing in generation is we're in the Spade Lake at the top of our state three. We went into the weekend, you know, right at the state two, state three line. We ran at 90 megawatts and we're still just about a half foot below the line between state two and state three. So 1429 change. Our plan is to reduce generation this week, conserve that water. We have a bigger price signal February or sometimes in March. And we also know that we've got some planned maintenance coming up in March. So it'll be a good time to refill the lake this spring with lower power prices, and we're going to be at reduced megawatts anyway.
Thank you, Jason. Thank you, Scott.
Any more updates?
No, that's it.
Okay. Next, we're moving to item four, public hearing 4A, our 2025 water general retail rates. I'll now give you a public hearing on the 2025 water general retail rates. If Christine aren't here, available to answer any questions and provide the previous presentation if necessary. Are there any comments from the public regarding the 2025 water general retail rates? And so please raise your hand. Hands up. Are there any questions or comments for you, commissioners?
I have none.
I will call for a motion to continue the public hearing on the 2025 water general rates. I don't know how I cannot put those four words together.
I move that the public hearing on the 2025 water general retail rates be continued to Tuesday, February 4, 2025 at 9 a.m. at 2320 California Street in Everett.
Commissioner, I'll call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Motion carries unanimously. Next, item 5, public hearing in action. 5A, consideration of resolution amending the district's residential, commercial, and industrial rate schedules to implement a 4.6 system average rate increase. I'll call for a motion.
I'm
now reconvening a public hearing. We have Peter Gonhauer here available to answer any questions and provide the prior presentation if necessary. Are there any comments from the public regarding this resolution? And so please raise your hand. Any hands up online or in the audience? Commissioners, do you have any questions or comments?
I have a comment. Rate changes are one of, the most important things that this board does. And we do struggle. These are tough calls. And an adjustment has been made this time based on what we perceive, I believe, in the short term are our needs. And I would just want to remind the board that we must think strategically. And while I do support the current action before us, I do want to make sure that we don't lose sight of a strategic look at sometimes a very unsure future. Mm-hmm. And predictions can change overnight. And so I just wanted to reiterate that as my perspective. And I would hope that we would continue to at least look at a longer-term strategy and how that might impact the customer long-term.
I have a comment as well. As much as I would like to support this, I want to abstain. This is my second meeting, and I wasn't part of all this planning of public hearings in the past when you're planning through the budget also. And I think that's not fair for me to support this when I have not 100% knowledge. And I wasn't present, I wasn't an engagement as well. So for that reason, I'm going to abstain.
I'll just know we've spent a lot of time on this, and this is a larger rate increase than we've had in the past. But I'll note that our neighbors in the last, since our last meeting, our IOU neighbors announced a rate increase that was more than triple this one. So it was a lot of economic pressures on all organizations with inflation. And so I appreciate all staff's hard work on this. I will close the public hearing and I'll call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay, or aye. Say abstain.
Aye.
Abstain.
Okay, the motion passes 2-0. Next is 5B, consideration of resolution amending the district's water retail rates and charges to pass through City of Everett purchased water cost increase. I'll call for a motion.
I move approval.
Okay, I will now reconvene a public hearing. We have Christina Arndt available to answer any questions and provide the prior presentation if necessary. I'll first ask if there's any comments from the public regarding the resolution. If so, please raise your hand. See any hands up online or in the room? Commissioners, do you have any questions or comments about this resolution?
I have none.
I have none either. I will call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Motion carries unanimously. Next, commission business. Are there any reports, Commissioner?
Excuse me, I have no report.
Reports or comments?
Well, we attend the Chamber of Commerce opening.
Well, that was interesting.
That was lovely. A lot of people, and yes, that was very effective. We have a good time. Thank you.
Yeah, I went to the fuel meeting. That was interesting too. Okay. Next is our Commissioner Events calendar, 7B. Are there any changes to the event calendar? Andy, I will say, this reminds me, when I went to the Camino Chamber, we had a Team PUD member there, which was nice, talking about our ways that our business customers can save energy, small businesses, so it was nice.
So I did believe
you're
attending the Chamber at the end of the month.
So. Okay, I think you're ready. Thank you. And I'm headed to Energy Northwest this afternoon.
I don't know if it's appropriate or not to bring this as an event, but I saw on Facebook that Sierra Club, they're going to visit the Arlington Center. And they invite some people. So that's part of the commissioners to be there, or I'm not.
I don't know. I hadn't heard about it. So they're touring the microgrid. Is that what?
Yes.
That what's happening?
Yes. So I saw that. It's interesting. I mean, it's an education. That's good to do that.
Yeah.
What is the group?
Sierra Club.
Oh, the Sierra Club. Okay.
Which is nice, but. I'm just curious if the commissioners can attend that or not. Thank you.
Good, that's a good question. It's Brenda White, Local Government Relations. I too received the invitation. It's a tour invite for the microgrid. They showcased a bunch of pictures, just the encouragement for their members to attend. I did reach out to our storage team, and they're all ready to prepare for those guests. So it would be led by Jessica Spar.
And Commissioner Altman, of course, did he ask the question? Is it appropriate for a commissioner to participate?
So, any reason for that?
I'm looking at the clerk.
Yeah, under our governance policy, GP5, you are allowed to attend events. The only restriction is whether it's budgeted or not, but this would be a nominal expense, if any. So it's certainly intended that you would coordinate with the clerk on your attendance, unless there's any objection from the rest of the commission.
I think it would be important.
I've never been there, so.
Just as an introduction to what that technology is, yeah. I've been there so many times that I don't think I'm sorry, I don't come in here to change dynamics.
It's a good question. We typically go to those things if other electeds are going, but you know, I don't know when it is, I would be interested in going only just to make connections with the Sierra Club, which yes. Don't really have those connections.
I wasn't aware of it, but I'll find out the date, make sure there's no conflicts with anything commission wise, and then we'll have to go to this public hearing.
Yeah, and I'm great with any of you that want to attend an event like that. I think that's always good.
Thank you.
Next is our governance planning calendar, 7A. Questions or changes to the governance planning calendar? Items to add?
I have no items to add. However, in our morning email from the clerk, there's a request for feedback on the potential March retreat.
Yes.
For education on the governance policies and discussion on changes in the email.
Yeah, what date was that?
That's the 13th.
13th, okay.
What time?
Usually they're 8 to 5.
Okay.
No. They are usually 8 to 5, and if everybody's available March 13th, I'll go ahead and start reserving that.
I'll have to let you know where it's going to be.
Okay.
And there was something I was going to bring up under events calendar. Go back to it. This new format is still, I'm always thinking this is the end of the meeting, not the middle of the meeting. February 24th to 26th, we have the American Public Power Association legislative rally on the calendar. And I just want to confirm that it's not like Commissioner Alperin-Crossi is going, and you're...
Again, as I've mentioned in previous years, I believe we have two very capable commissioners. You're attending, correct?
I am.
Two very capable commissioners representing the community, and I'm not comfortable on spending our ratepayers' money to say. Thank you.
So any, I guess there's no changes to governance planning calendar other than we have a tentative workshop in March. Okay. Next, we move on to item 8, our CEO General Manager briefing session. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
I thought it's a good afternoon.
Yeah, lots of good stuff. First up, an update on our artificial intelligence and Chris Rich. Good morning, Chris. Good
morning. Good morning. I'm Chris Bridge. I'm the Senior Manager of Data and Analytics here at the district. I give the topic of artificial intelligence for 10 minutes, which probably could take 10 hours. It's a big one, but I'll do my best to keep it under 10 minutes. So today, what I wanted to bring as an update to the board was where we're at in our maturity here at the district, and the framework we're adopting that will help us measure our success in this journey, and also the tasks that we need to continually do to make this a safe and effective technology for the district. They're want to give you kind of an idea of where we've been in our roadmap so far and what's our journey to date. There's been lots of successes already and hopefully many more to come. And where we are in the maturity curve, it's a kind of a common technology thing, where we're at in the use of this technology and the foundation we put in place already for it. The framework we have adopted now to help us is given to us by Gartner. Many corporations, companies, utilities that have used this use these tasks in the right order and use them as measuring our success have had successful implementations of AI over time. This is very common in a lot of technologies, but I find it even more important with the transformational technology that is AI. It's going to help us pinpoint those things we need to get better at, continually improve in, and it'll help direct our strategic direction in this tool. I'm going to go over a few of these, not every single one of these today. It'll take a while, but I'm going to highlight some of the key ones that I think that would be important for you to hear. Our strategy, strategy here has been going for over the last year. This has been led by Melissa Machida, Senior Manager of Data and Information Governance, and she had quickly formed our AI advisory team back in the late 2020, early 2023, and quickly enacted our interim policies. This technology kind of hit the world, and we reacted, and her and her group did a fantastic job getting us in the place we need to be immediately. And then worked very closely with the ELT and moved us in the direction to form a strategy that was approved in June of 2024. And in that roadmap, many of the things that were done were creating the AI governance policies, putting all our cybersecurity, whether it be risk mitigation or our security controls, and then the literacy that the organization needed to know what is this thing that just hit us. What is AI and what does it mean to the district? Next in this strategy and working down this road now to start mapping out what our use cases are with these technology. What does the utility use this for? We are using it some now already. We'll talk a little bit about that later. But then we need to start mapping out what the actual work is going to look like in these spaces and what additions and roles we need to do that. And we'll see that later as well. So value, why are we doing this if there was no value? Well, there's lots of value and we need to manage that. There's so many use cases in this technology, which makes it so transformative that we are managing all these use cases directly within our district strategic plan. Anything, we don't work on things unless they're driving our direction. And then when they are something we're going to do, we leverage our internal agile processes, which help us manage these use cases and be able to then essentially build or provide the solutions required. Value has been directly in generative AI immediately. Some of the key, some of the top four, I think this slide could be on almost any company's. But we are leveraging the Microsoft business applications, and we decided that we were comfortable in the space with starting AI. So document creation of every kind of document you can think of in the Microsoft landscape is now a lot easier to do. It helps you get started on things way quicker than you once did. In the world of IT, I know many are using it as a programming and coding aid. It's not always perfect, but it surprisingly teaches you code really fast than maybe the old days, and it definitely helps. I think a key for most common across all jobs is research acceleration. I mean, you can research things so quickly now with AI and with the ability to look those up. Where did it get its answers from? Which is a key part of that. You just don't accept what you got back from AI. You do your research yourself too, but it speeds up that process greatly. And then lastly, the organization of our communications. I know one of the use cases Microsoft really has sold is the ability to manage your Outlook communications in different ways and help traverse your It's one of those things where you have 4,000 emails. It can help you go through them quickly and do lots of different ways to organize that information and pull the information out of your emails. It's close cousin machine learning. It's something we've done here for a while already. We have things that we have been recently doing, working with Peter's team with electrical vehicle detection. We're working with all the Peter's team, and which is rates and economics, and working on AMI customer load profiles. How can we extrapolate those out where we haven't, and nobody's got their AMI meter yet, but we are able to extrapolate it out through machine learning and start giving us ideas sooner than later what that might look like for the county. And then we've always used it for estimated time of restoration, and further enhances that as we move further down that journey with our outage communications, things like that.
So I got a question.
Yes.
Really, something really ignorant, because I don't know much about this, but you know, one of the things I've seen in conferences is conversations about teaching public AI models, things about your organization, or your programming, potentially that language is now out there for competitors. We don't really have competitors in those sense, but is the AI we're using, is that learning kept in-house in our a Microsoft account, or if we're writing code, is that
we're
now another utility can use that code, or what, how does this work?
Yeah, in the sense of code, no, the code is in-house, it's behind our firewall and our tools that we're using it.
Okay.
But it's more the example of, I don't know how to code something. I need to know, like, what is the right syntax for this certain thing? You can go out and ask that question. We're not putting our code out there. We're actually putting English or text or whatever the language we're speaking out in there for it to come back and give us the right syntax. And then we can go back into our code behind our firewalls and do our work. Yeah, so it's an extension of research, essentially. It's allowing us to research something we might have used to pull out an old SQL book on the shelf and try to read, how do I do this thing? Now you can ask it to help us. So no, it's not storing that kind of stuff up there.
Is it storing anything? Out in
well, it's taking in what your prompts are, what you're asking.
Okay.
And then what you're asking, what it comes back with, that's what it's learning on. That's what the Microsoft's model, which they bought, since brought over ChatGPT's model into Microsoft. Everything you ask is a prompt, and its replies that come back, it starts learning over time if that was the correct response or not. That's essentially what AI, generative AI is.
Okay, so in that sense, it is shared. We are asking it about trends in Snohomish and Allen County.
That's the kind of stuff.
That learning,
yes.
It may be used by the next person who.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you go back one slide, please?
Sure.
I'm ignorant in this. So when you mention about you utilize that with electric vehicles detection. So for example, could you elaborate a little bit about that?
Yeah, so this is electric vehicles put out certain variables associated to them, whether it be the information we get from the county, homes and the types of things that's been installed at a home, and then their profile. What does that profile look like when electric vehicle is plugged into a home? And it has a very distinct profile, and it helps us determine where we might see growth and where these electric vehicles are being installed throughout the service territory. So it helps, one, it helps Peter's team do load forecasts a little more accurately, knowing where we might see that stuff. And it also then helps our small area forecasting, where do we see possibly these popping up more than not. So it uses other variables in our actual electric profile of the homes, so we can see, so that one and the one below it kind of go together. We can see what that profile looks like. People come home and bam, see something got plugged in. That's going to help us provide better services to that customer, knowing that they're most likely have an electric vehicle.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So that's a good question. So when we have AMI data and we're using generative AI to analyze it, like you're talking about, potentially find electric vehicles or electric stoves or whatever, that is kept within our organization, right?
Right.
That's the
okay. Yes, absolutely. This one with AI and most anything where
bringing into the district here, but this one specifically, AI is so transformative. Change management was probably one of the biggest things we had to address immediately. This changes how people can work. And so immediately the advisory team worked with the Joint Labor Management Committee and quickly worked through what would that changes look like, and got that into the collective bargaining agreement in 2024. That was really important because it was clear this isn't, people are going to start using it regardless of what we do. And we need to be very, very quick with this. So Melissa and team did a really good job getting that going. Had commission updates, a lot of communication. This is has so many new acronyms. We have plenty here already. And I add, what's generative AI? What's machine learning? What's regular AI? All these things. So it was, we needed to have a lot of communications on what it wasn't to and what it is. We brought in, brought together the right roles. Now with this new technology, we needed definitely the right roles. People understanding this is something they need to watch. There may be levels of it for being able to give approvals and different things so that we were really governing this closely. So a lot of these roles were definitely around governance of it, and it still is, but a lot of, at first, it was just a lot of unknowns. And now we're moving more into the role of what do we need? What isn't here now that is going to make us be better with this technology and help manage it and manage its adoption? And lastly, again, training. A big part of this is not just knowing what AI is, but really it's understanding how to use it responsibly. So risk mitigation training, how to use it. It's part of the general training now. And as well as lots of skills training. There's so many new things to do in this that provided lots of different training across the Microsoft 365 business applications that you could, how you can use it. And so a lot of that has been done and will continue. This is growing rapidly. I think something new in Microsoft comes out every day. So we got it where there's going to be lots of new training in this area.
Commissioner,
yes.
The FTEs to support the technology, are those in the budget?
Yes.
All right. And though.
Good question.
He knows. I got a big dollar sign.
Yeah.
he also, as we transition, one thing I'd like to remind myself is that as we evolve, things will not be done the way they were. And so this is balanced out with opportunities for change. And I'm hoping that that's consideration as we evolve with AI.
That's why it's a deliberate and methodical process.
Yeah.
On how we.
Oh, I throughout this, I was very impressed with, now I'm going too far ahead, but with ongoing continuing assessment and value propositions and business cases. Very impressed with how that is a thread throughout this. Yeah. I'm done.
Thank you. One of the roles that I do want to kind of good segue is a new role is bringing a senior program manager onto my team. And why I'm highlighting this one specifically is this is such a transformational thing. It's going to change the way business processes can work, change just the general tools we can pull out of our tool belts every day to use at our job here at the utility. That this needs somebody who's watching it closely and who's going to help bring everybody along and partner with, like I said, the JLMC, man, all levels of leadership, whether you're technical, whether you're business, somebody needs to be in the middle of all this, helping guide us through this journey. And so this role was one of the first that was called out. Moving down the road a little, as I've received this role, it's quickly in my space, which is data and analytics. It's really artificial intelligence, machine learning, what just use data science as a term, with analytics and the automation of processes is so intermixed now, seamless almost with AI. It's hard to tell which is doing what. And so it was clear that these need to be the focus of this person's role. And they will be working with all AGMs on their strategic roadmaps where these tools can be useful, whether it be for our customers or for our grid or for our own internal employees. This is an important role. I'll get a little more on the roadmap when that's kind of happening. I do want to call out risk mitigation. This was a very largely led DIG effort. We needed governance and we needed it quick. And they did a fantastic job of getting everybody up to speed, the use policies, and we're able to quickly communicate it out. That's what impressed me the most, is there was very little confusion. What it was you're supposed to do and not supposed to do with this technology. That alone was a huge win right away. And then on top of it, very detailed policies that now we have teams that help enforce them. This is kind of a grand whole bunch of tech slide, but the idea is a lot of stuff has been done and a lot of different facets of governance and security have been put in place and is still being put in place as we move down this journey from risk mitigation, very strict security controls with AI, lots of training and lots of assessments, auditing of ourselves in this space. So we know we're moving ahead in the right directions and can find any of those weak points that we may not see right today. This is a lot of the space is the cybersecurity space. And Kevin Johnson will definitely be talking with you guys later, I'm sure, about some of this in his briefing with cybersecurity. But this is kind of the highlight slide of a lot of work was done in this space.
The one part I'm missing, and maybe it's in here, is protecting customer data. And so I can see, and AMI is obviously the easiest way to look at that. Obviously, if you can predict someone has an electric car, you can probably predict if they're home or not. We use for nefarious reasons. So what do we have built into our policies that protect our customer data?
We have
potential bad actors.
Well, even before any of this, we've had third-party data policies, data input policies, is essentially how we can send data from one person to another, whether it's in district, out of district, or from between a third-party entity. So those policies were actually in place prior to AI hitting the maps that we don't do that. We don't send things outside the district unless they go to the formal privacy review. They go through a governance, you know, we follow a step-by-step policy on when we send data anywhere. Even when it's inside our own walls, we have specific policies on just in case we printed it out or we sent it here, that we don't have PII or any health information of any kind sitting out on something that could be picked up by anybody. So yeah, very strict policies in place on that.
I'm glad that you mentioned that interesting question, because always it's good to have reminders to our customers, to our clients, to our people, the data that we use through this, I mean, it's confidential all the time, even though that we know, but it's nice to see verifications or reminders all the time. Yes.
The analysis of any customer information is done behind our walls. And there is a little section here on the data that I don't know if I did in this region. So roadmap, where have we been? So a really key part of the initial successes that has been in the space so far is getting right people together. We needed to quickly bring a group together to help advise and lead to the strategic approval of this technology. We needed those people then to take us into what are the processes we need, what are the use policies, what are any kind of governance strategy we needed, and also where is this going? Some decisions on it's here, but we need to know where it's going to go. And then ultimately, so that the technology was here, we owned all these business applications in the Microsoft space, and now they just turned on this little thing that said Copilot for everybody to use. So we had to quickly learn what that meant and and were able to and quickly enable those and turn them on, knowing that they were going to be safely here at the district. And what's to come? Very similar trend, except now we're kind of getting down a level into what are the specific resource needs we need to do to implement this future adoption of this technology, the program management processes we're going to need in place so that we can watch it closely and lead where it's going to go. And also, while at the same time working with this new role, having the operations literally established on how we process these requests and get them done and get the use cases going, and whatever projects may come out of this, what are the actual operational tasks that need to be done, and controls brought down from a governance standpoint, but down to the operation. Like, I'm about to do this thing with this tool. What can I, not do? And more from a developer standpoint, I'm a building AI now. What are the things I'm not supposed to do? How do I bring this through a change control so that I provide a very safe, unbiased result for the users of the district?
I'm sorry, what is a JLMC?
Joint Labor Management Committee. Really tiny line. I tried spelling it out, but it got really big. And then lastly, to get that into the hands of the people who are going to start working on these things, this is a technology that can be used by within a development team, kind of more traditional IT team, as well as self-service with some of our business users, depending on the tool. There are levels of this tool now, and that's where we need to learn what the right way to secure those things and get the right access to the right people. And so it's starting to fall a little more into some of the technology space now, how we're going to enable that for them. And lastly, kind of where are we at compared to how the world always looks at AI's maturity? I think the general rule, or not rule, but what I grabbed from this myself when I built this and kind of laid out what I thought we look like, it kind of came out where I thought, the world of AI is prescriptive, is kind of that traditional AI. You know, I can, one example is sometimes you'll have like an online system and they'll pop up and go, hey, I noticed you used a lot of energy yesterday. Do you know about this product that could help you? That's prescriptive AI. Generative AI is what we're seeing now with all the fancy new tools and Microsoft, get the Copilot asking questions. That's generative AI. Then cognitive AI is what I call science fiction. That's when we're out robots thinking for us, and right, it's out. That's quite a ways out there, right? But it's not too far out anymore. It's not quite science fiction anymore. But we have set a foundation in place, I think a very strong foundation because we did it right, which was we set the governance and use policy, and we set a strategy to build ourselves upon first. Now we're moving into the roles of, okay, well, we're in that generative AI capabilities now. We have these things, but now we're putting the people in place to help us get to those next levels, or at least traverse through them because they're coming to us, whether we choose to or not. So we need to have the people in place to do that. And that's kind of our next step in this phase of our maturity.
So do you have any predictions about what kind of anything AI uses we might be seeing for the utility in a couple of years?
Well, there are, you know, the big part of it falls within customer service is obviously like the chatbot, the idea that you can have the all-knowing person who can answer every question you want and sit behind your computer. That's a really common one. The big ones that are kind of the really interesting ones are for grid asset maintenance and fire mitigation. A lot of vegetation management is using the AI system with drones. And lately there have been a new kind of push with using GPS imagery. They're finding it actually costs less because it's already data that we're taking pictures of our earth, and they're finding it works just as well as flying a plane over. And so there's a few utilities that a few on my team are already talking to about what they're doing with the GPS data that imagery using it for that. Wildfire obviously is seeing where things are growing, and does it look like we're overgrown again in areas, and that could be a potential risk for fire.
And that's a big piece of them. So a lot of aerial photography, using imagery for that. It's kind of a really big push right now. I kind of lean towards some of those still need some work in areas because it's not a perfect science, right? It's still a prediction. But I think in the world of our customers, with how we can help them is the most immediate value because it's a known quantity and it's a known ability that this will help speed up a lot of the interactions with our customers to help them serve their needs. So the value starts there.
Yeah, that's interesting because I've always thought this would be a place where I don't actually, I've called in our number, I've always called in person, but so many customer service calling an organization, you get stuck with prompts that are silly, not silly, but prompts that you don't need because you've already gone to the website or used the app or whatever. So it's like the common issues, but not the challenging issues. And you just find yourself mad and punching numbers trying to get out of it to talk to them. So it seems like there's some real possibility there.
Yeah, it reverses the who's asking the question.
Yeah.
You're asking it instead of going through a list of questions, perhaps one, right, in a kind of like a phone thing. Instead, you're going in and saying, I want to know this about whatever about my utility.
Yeah.
It then comes back with it. That's the difference. It reverses that conversation.
There's a challenge, you know.
Maybe you've got lots of ideas already. All right. Thank you.
Any other questions for Chris?
No, I have none.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
I really appreciate it.
Good job, Chris. Can you take a break?
Sure. Let's take a 5-minute break or 4-minute break. Come back at 10:15. You want a laundry break? You want a laundry break? We can take a 9-minute break. We'll take a 9-minute break and come back at 10:20. It's 10:20 when we're back. And before we resume our general manager briefing session, that meeting you referenced with the Sierra Club meeting that's going to the microgrid is Thursday, and I won't be able to attend. So it will just be you. Sure. All right.
Great. Next up is Harrison Mark and our 2025 Integrated Resource Plan, A1 review. Good morning, Harrison.
Morning, John. Morning, Commissioners. Garrison Marr, the Senior Manager of Power Supply. And you all are in for a treat because the next 3 presentations are all Power Supply presentations. So I guess, you know, some excitement and some apologies. I'm going to be brief because I know there's 3 of these. Just want to tee up what this IRP presentation is going to be about and what we're asking from you, the commissioners, during this presentation. So about a year ago, we came to the commission and we said, we want to do a lot more public engagement. We want to get out in more parts of the community. We want to do online. We want to be in more parts of the service territory. We even want to offer some Spanish language resources. We've done those things, and the intent really was to listen to our customers really fully as we develop a scope for this IRP, which is our long-term power plan and strategy for how we're going to serve our loads in the future. So today, we're coming back to you after many months of work, lots of people putting their heads together, a lot of listening, to propose the scope of that IRP so that the really smart IRP team, composed of Chris, Landon, and 50-plus subject matter experts that form a tech team, can execute that study scope, bring back a strategy and power plan by the end of this year, and satisfy our regulatory obligations. So that's what the game plan is today, to talk about that scope and how we got there. The ask is really just for your candid feedback, questions along the way. We want to keep moving the ball forward because we're on a really tight timeline, but we want to be responsive to feedback so that we can incorporate that into the work too. So don't be shy. ask the questions that you've got, and we've been working hard for you, and this is that show. So, Chris, if you want to take it from here.
Thank you.
I guess the only thing I would ask as we go through this, since we're transitioning to load following, I'd like to understand how that changes.
Sure.
The IRP and what we need.
Okay.
If at all.
We can get into that.
Great.
Good morning, commissioners. My name is Chris Getter. I work in the Water Supply Department here at the PD doing long-term planning. We're going to go a little bit of review and refresher, get everybody back up to speed. It's been about 9 months since we came to you, so it's been quite a while. So you might reasonably be asking, what is an IRP? The IRP is the district's long-term resource plan, and we do these every couple years. There's two flavors of IRP. There's a comprehensive and an update. This 2025 IRP is a comprehensive IRP, meaning that we create a new scope, and we create a whole new document. We don't bring anything over from the 2021 IRP. So the IRP looks at a wide range of potential outcomes that the district could face over the next 20 years. And we look for the lowest reasonable cost of service to meet all of our regulatory and customer needs. The IRP also sets our 2-year conservation targets. It sets our near-term action plan, and it provides for the CETA clean energy implementation plan that we can talk about here in just a minute. So you might hear a couple terms: CETA, Clean Energy Transformation Act. CEIP is the Clean Energy Implementation Plan. That's part of that. I-937 or Energy Independence Act or EIA. Those are all synonymous. That requires a renewable portfolio standards, the PUD, and part of that is that we establish our 2-year conservation targets that my colleague here in the room, Michael Coe, gets to implement as part of our action. So that's kind of the broad scope of what we're doing here. So an integrated resource plan at the highest level, we look at a wide range of potential futures, and we look at what the future could look like from here until 2045. So our study scope goes from 2025 to 2045, and a lot can change between now and midway through the 2040s. Fundamentally, what we're doing is taking a big old math equation. We're looking at our projected needs and our forecast needs. We're looking at our current power portfolio and then potential needs in the future and what we could be adding within that time frame to meet those potential needs. We look for times when we're short or when we might want to add a resource for various reasons. And then we look to find the best cost or the best resource to meet those needs at the lowest reasonable cost we can for our customers. Then once we have all that, right, we've got our new plan going forward, we take that and turn it into a cohesive plan for the district and a roadmap to get us from where we are today in 2025 all the way out to 2045 at the end of the study period. A related document to the IRP is the CEIP, the Clean Energy Implementation Plan. The CEIP requires a public process, and we run that public process in parallel with our IRP public process. Part of the CEIP public process is to identify vulnerable populations as we define them here at the district and determine the impacts to those vulnerable populations, whether they're positive or negative, right? They could be either direction, establish 4-year measures and targets, conservation targets and demand response targets, and the impacts of those decisions on those vulnerable populations. We did our first CEIP in 2021. So 2025, we're going to expand upon that. And I'll talk a little bit more about what we heard in the CEIP a little bit down the slide there. So let me give you a little bit of high-level processing. We divide our IRP into 5 phases. We're here at the end of, in the beginning of January, right here at the end of phase 1, which is our scoping process. We began this
all the way back in January of 2024. We've been working really hard over the past 12 months to get to where we're at today. Since March, we've been working hard on our public process, developing our scope, and we're at the end of that. We're starting to crunch numbers. We're looking at that phase two resource balance as well. And we're working, we've started on the resource options, looking at what our potential options are so that we can move into that phase four optimization. We have a pretty tight timeline, as Garrison mentioned. We have to get this done by the end of 2025. We must adopt the 2025 IRP by December. So we have a lot to get through, but overall, it's a really exciting time to be a PUD power planner. So it's kind of the timeline at a glance. You'll see more of this at the end of the day. Let me talk about what the core of today I want to talk about is the public engagement process. The PUD, we try to use a customer-centric public process that starts by listening to our customers and what their priorities are. We're trying to understand their concerns, their core questions, and what they think about the future in terms of their energy. We did more public engagement this time around than we ever have before. And I want to talk a little bit about some of the things we heard from our customers. But I do have to give a big shout out to our Corp Comp team. Public engagement team really helped us out. There were a lot of PUD folks that showed up to all these meetings, oftentimes after hours or on weekends. So really couldn't have done it without them. It's big help, and we really want to express a thanks. The first thing we did was we had a community listening session here at the district. We did a virtual open house. We did four in-person open houses. And then we had a table at the energy block party. So let's start off with the community leaders forum. So for our community leaders listening session, we invited local Snohomish County businesses, non-governmental organizations, other government agencies, across the board. Clean energy and sustainability were all important to our customers. They had clean energy goals or sustainability goals. So in light of either legislation that they think is coming down the road, or they have their own organizational goals, they told us that clean energy and sustainability were key for them. Another key message we heard was that reliability and affordability were important to our customers. And that's a really common theme we heard across the board, whether it was here at this listening session or throughout the rest of the meetings with the rest of the public. From our industrial customers, they expressed to us that they've done a lot of conservation efforts with the PUD, and they're starting to think about more expansive conservation efforts. They told us they've kind of gotten the low-hanging fruit, and now some of the next steps or the next tranche of available conservation to them are more system level upgrades. So taking a whole steam system out and replacing it with electric system as part of their electrification. And that is going to be more expensive and more costly for them, and it'll take a lot longer. So that was kind of one of their concerns before us. Secondly, almost all of our customers here, almost all of our customers here did plan to electrify their fleets or their business operations. So we're starting to see more interest in electric vehicles at the fleet level and more electrification at the business or organizational level. The next thing we did, we hosted six open houses across the service territory. We had a table at the Utility of the Future room for the Energy Block Party last year. We hosted an open house here at the Electric Building in Everett. We had one at the Clean Energy Center in Linwood. We had one in Arlington. We had one in Linwood at an elementary school, and then we had one in Snohomish that we had folks attend. And then we had one online power talks that we did on long-term planning. Our customers told us almost universally that affordability and reliability were high priorities for them. And clean energy resources were highly valued by our customers. Some customers did indicate a concern that the cost of electrification may not be, they were concerned about the cost of electrification and causing increased rates or potential grid reliability problems was the other aspect they mentioned. During our open houses, we talked about the vulnerable populations that we were using in our CEIP. And for the 2021 CEIP, we used two. They were energy burdened households and distribution constrained customers. Energy burdened households are households with 7% or more of their energy or of their income spent on energy bills. Distribution constrained customers were customers who live on distribution circuits who that have maybe less room for future upgrades for future local expansion. So during the open house process, our customers felt our vulnerable populations definitions still made sense, but they did mention including renters in our definition for energy burdened households. We thought that made a lot of sense. So we're going to add some language surrounding that, surrounding renters for vulnerable population descriptions. And we'll do that as we move through the CEIP process.
So let's stay on this public engagement sure. process. So other than making the change about rental customers, I'm curious, I mean, I know this is part of the process we have to do. And, you know, it's great we're reaching out to so many people for nothing else, just to help them understand about the utility. But I'm curious, what's the usually the outcome of this? Is it we change our load forecast based on this information? We pick different resources based on this information. How does this move the ball?
Garrison Maher, Senior Manager of Power Supply. We really use it for forecasting and tracking, specifically those investment types and those opportunities that could be available within our service territory. So utility scale wind farm, if we're thinking about something like that, right? That doesn't necessarily have a local impact because wind is most productive outside of Snohomish County. But for conservation investments or smart rate options that customers could elect, we want to make sure that we're measuring geospatially where those customers could be. And that's on a forecast basis, right? Do people have access to these planned investments across the service territory in a reasonable way? And then we want to track on the other side, well, what actually happened? Did we expect that there would be, you know, broad-based participation in these things, but see something else? And if that's the case, what are the reasonable things that we can do to see if we can get broader participation? You know, is it marketing, different things like that? So it's really the planning and measurement that get informed, and these metrics help us say, well, did we serve, you know, equitably these communities that we think could benefit from these things?
Thank you.
I don't know if you have the desegregated data here, but I'm really interested to know how the six community events, how many people attend. I attend one in Lingwood,
yep.
And Cedar Valley, and I wish that more people attend those because they are very educational. I learned a lot. It's too bad somehow. Maybe the outreach didn't go intentionally, and I don't point fingers and say this in a negative way, but it's like how we can address it and how we can do better. For example, in Lingwood, when I was working as a city council, if we want to reach out people, we always go to the food bank, a Lingwood food bank. And relationships are crucial. So the executive director, Alisa, she's really open. So in that parking lot, it's a sense of belonging already. and they are sitting there waiting, more than 500 families that are so diverse, that while they're waiting, you can introduce yourself, and you have a table there and doing all this outreach and engagement and introduce something, because I can tell you that many people, they know now that I am a commissioner, they have no idea what the PUD has. And I didn't even know either until I started to educate myself, and I still educate myself. So yes, renters, yes, vulnerable people, but what more we can do in order to, I don't know how many people attend those, but if we see population, it's not Snohomish County, we have like 800, 900 plus. So what percentage is enough for us, and see and say, okay, this is feasible and it's equitable, because we are reach out 3% or 4% of this population. So I don't know. So somehow how we can do, and I'm interested to know who attend those, and how many people.
Yep. So over the course of the 6 events, we had something on the order of 50 odd people in person, and then we have another 30 people online. So reasonably well attended for a power planning meeting. Let's be honest, power planning is not something most people like to do during the summer on their after work. They probably want to go do baseball or something else. That is one thing we've worked with our CorpCom team, our public engagement team, is to reimagine and re-envision how we can do this so we can reach out and touch more of those communities. So each of these events was a learning opportunity for us. And I think next time around, we'll look, we're hoping, we'll cross our fingers.
That are you going to donate more time to continue to do this? No. So you only experience with these 6 and that's it? Okay.
Yeah, this time around.
Well, but maybe with your outcomes, it's worth if you can share this with churches, food banks, chamber of commerce, and schools, districts, and every single organization, so you can imagine. So
yeah. One of the things we did learn across these events was that if we go to where the people are, we tend to get better responses rather than people
from us. Absolutely. And some communities, they are available for 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. because everybody's working, have the opportunity to pay for babysitter or things like that. Yeah. Okay, but thank you for all that you do. Really appreciate it.
Commissioner, your input is very good. And it's always good to have a new commissioner, identifies what the need is. And staff, I know, is working very hard to expand that input. But I must say, I don't know what the formula is, because it's a very complex industry. And what I've gone out and talked about it, about 10 minutes, not maybe I'm a poor speaker, but about 10 minutes into it, they glaze over. They want to know what their bill's going to be, and they're going to want to know when they're going to be out of power and when they're going to be restored. And you get it beyond that. So I don't know. Do we reach out to other utilities? Do they have the same experience we do?
We have not reached out to other utilities.
No, in terms of their programs.
We've reached out to a ton of utilities, and we do far more than the majority of the other peer utilities. We did double public events. The last IRP, we did double the public events. This IRP, we did probably talk to, a couple hundred people through the course of the block party. We have done different things like residential surveys and focus groups. We've really tried every conceivable thing to reach our folks.
Yeah.
I think Chris is right that power planning is probably not everybody's passion. But that is not going to stop us from trying more ways to reach folks and to do better every single time. So the feedback that we're getting now is super important for us because IRPs happen every 2 years. And as soon as this one is filed, I promise we are going to start the next IRP. And we want to be better and better and connect more with our customers because it's so important to us. So we wish we got more folks. We got what we got. We have to stay on this timeline, but we will absolutely roll forward so we can get better and better.
How difficult it is.
It
can be. We're not a sexy industry.
It is. And I'm sorry, I don't underestimate your report. Not at all. I always applaud, that you go out and you come for some because you went there with the people at. And I really appreciate it. How they set up all these, the education resources and the tables. And I really enjoy it. There are things that I didn't know because, well, I was born and raised in Mexico and I grew up over there. Over there, we don't have that part of educational piece. I can promise to you that vulnerable populations, refugee immigrants populations, if you put three containers in front of us, we don't know what is recycled. You'll say, hey, come on, I want to throw out my garbage. That's it. But it's the piece, the education is a room of opportunity for us to engage with those communities. And as you were there, so people are still talking about it. Because I received the comments like when they are going to go outside again. So that is a good piece. And I never underestimate your work. So thank you for everything that you do. We appreciate it.
Well, we appreciate the feedback and we're going to continue to build it up.
I think Garrison mentioned this, some of the opportunity that we want to continue to try to grow is it's hard to attract customers or folks from the community on this one particular topic. It's easier to lure them into the energy block party or at some of the other events and fairs that we have booths, and we can talk about all kinds of different things to continue to try to educate our folks. And as Garrison said, Chris, Garrison, Landon, we're all at the block party and they're luring people over to talk about IRP and our energy portfolio and how clean it is, all those kind of things. So it's, again, just trying to think of all the different venues where we can talk about all the good things, inclusive of our power supply mix.
No, and I saw you also in the library being open. And there was a table there and I stopped by and there was a lot of people. So you are doing a fantastic work, but yes, thank you.
Yeah, feedback is really helpful. So thank you. So moving along, after we've done our public process out completely, we then went and established our subject matter expert tech team that Garrison was talking about. You have more than 50 SMEs on the tech team covering 19 departments across the district, plus an external consulting firm who's doing our demand response potential assessment. I don't want to list off all the departments here. It's quite a long list. It might take up a minute, but just note that we have a lot of help here, and we really couldn't have done it without all the hard work from all the rest of the PUD staff. So big thank you to everybody that was there. We went through a 6-week process to determine the elements that are going to make up the study. We started by asking a series of questions regarding what the tech team members were thinking about and hearing about in their industry and in their daily work. So, and then we asked about the potential impacts to the district and the likelihood of that theme or whatever coming up. So once we had all that, we collated it into this. It is a busy slide, so I apologize.
I find it fascinating. I believe
I'm not going to go over everything that's on this slide. Feel free to take a look a little bit later if you want, but putting it all together, we have from left to right, we have the likelihood of the element impacting the district. And then from top to bottom, we have the impact. So at the top is a positive impact, at the bottom is a negative impact. Generally across the board, the impacts were pretty well distributed from an impact perspective, but
they were all deemed fairly likely to happen. So we took the most commonly heard elements and the most impactful elements to from the tech team, and then that's what we turned into our study scope, and we turned into our scenarios and sensitivities, which I'll talk about here in just a second. But if you want to mention, you know, some of these things are common themes you'll hear throughout the rest of the IRP process. So if one isn't explicitly called out, it is definitely something we're thinking about. So these are the results from our public process and our tech team surveys. We took all these elements and turned them into our scenarios and sensitivities. There's quite a few overlaps, even if the words maybe aren't the same, the themes or the ideas are very similar between what we heard from our customers and what we heard from our tech team members. So we're really confident that we have a set of scenarios that address the commonly heard interests and questions from the community at large. Some of these elements will show up down the road as we go through these future briefings, such as load forecasting and resource acquisition or resource options. So you might hear some of these recurring themes over and over and over again.
Yeah. Yes.
I just have a question, and maybe it's not even something that is appropriate for this, but on the customer identified interests, are these in order, in sequence of what's the most important to them?
Nope.
Okay, thank you.
I don't know that I have an order here of any kind, so.
Okay, I'm fine.
So let me talk about what scenarios and sensitivities are. So these kind of define the scope of the document, so it's probably useful to give you an overview of where we're at. So a scenario will examine the resource additions for the PUD's long-term power plan, where several variables are changing at any given time. So in this case, we have five scenarios that we're going to be looking at. A sensitivity is when we take a single variable within, in this case, our base case, and vary it to see the impact on our resource decisions. Each scenario and sensitivity solve for the lowest reasonable cost of service for that set of variables that are assigned. And then we learn from all of that, and we can develop a power plan that sort of reacts or that lives within all of them. We take all the learning, and then we can remain flexible to potential future changes. One thing I do want to mention is that each of these scenarios and sensitivities contributes to our learning opportunities. So here's, yeah.
You have a question on this, an observation, and maybe the third bullet, scenarios and sensitivity, both solve for the lowest cost solution. Quite often, that's at odds with providing a reliable power. So is lowest cost solution appropriate here, or is it reasonable cost?
Well, I think it says lowest to provide reliable.
Well, lowest cost solution to provide reliable.
From a power supply standpoint, it's different than.
And maybe I'm mixing rates and the supply side of the house.
Well, I think power supply is different from a reliability standpoint than T&D.
Okay.
We can spend a lot more money, trim more trees, put more equipment, and improve the reliability. I think from a power supply, having enough power to provide or to meet our customer needs is the baseline. It's how to do that most affordably. In other words, it's not like customers expect we're going to have storms, there are going to be some outages. I don't believe that's the case on the power supply. They expect that we will provide power. So it's a little different scenario. Garrison and Chris can probably explain it much better than I.
I'm not going to take more time on it. It's something that stood out.
If I might just briefly, this might be an opportunity to put a bow on Commissioner Logan's question earlier about how does this IRP differ given the transition to the load following product? So in previous IRPs where we were block and slice and it was uncertain how much power we could get from the slice product, we had to plan the IRPs, right, to capture the financial risk of how much we need might need to invest in resources, as well as the delivery risk, which might be having enough power to serve our needs, right? And really making sure that we had a buffer, some insurance there to make sure that we were all good. The biggest thing that changes as we transition to the load following product is that we now have a standard backstop of the BPA, which is a right load following is a full requirements product, which means Bonneville stands behind us and flexes up and down. So primarily we're looking at the financially optimal solutions, which includes the cost of the resources in the portfolio, but also, and importantly, the cost of regulatory compliance, which is a big component and a big portfolio driver for us. So reliable service should be held pretty constant because Bonneville is standing behind all of these portfolio solutions. We're really optimizing financially the best cost that we can get for our customers, and the reliability should be uniform across those.
Thank you.
Okay. So, as I mentioned, we have five scenarios. We developed these all from the tech team elements and what we heard in the public process. So the five are the base case, high growth, low growth, high tech, and limited renewables. So the base case in this instance is our expected scenario. So think benign weather, expected market prices, expected resource costs, expected EPA costs. It kind of is our building block for everything else. So that's where we start. It's our center point. And then everything else will kind of move off from there one way or the other. You can think of the high tech scenario as if the region is experiencing an economic boom. So loads are higher, resource costs are higher, regional needs are higher in that case. So we basically have a uniform increase across the board. The low growth is kind of the flip side of that coin, right? If the region is experiencing an economic downturn, we have lower load growth, lower needs across the region, lower resource costs. So they're kind of flip-flops from one another. High-tech case is interesting because we allow new technology to develop faster in this scenario, both on the consumer side and on the resource side. So in this case, electric vehicle adoption is increased. More people are adopting home technology solutions like heat pumps and smart thermostats. Energy storage is more prevalent across the regional footprint because we've allowed more energy storage into the footprint. And in that case, utility prices are lower and volatility is lower on the wholesale market price because of the capacity that's in the system. So in this case, energy capacity is just the ability to meet and flex as demand, flex the output as demand goes up and down. So an energy storage solution will smooth the output of a variable wind or solar type resource. The last one here, limited renewables. So I think it was mentioned earlier, might've been Commissioner Olson. You said regions experienced challenges building transmission or we have limited transmission. In this case, that was also brought up by our tech team and our customers as grid reliability concerns. So in this case, we are limiting the availability of renewables to a later period in the study, a later period for us. And that can, lead times for renewables can be quite long. Transmission projects take a long time to build. So we're delaying resource availability to the district. And it could result in elevated wholesale market prices. So these are the five scenarios that we've developed.
I've got a question on limited renewables.
Sure.
So is that limited? Is that Bonneville's ability to bring on limited renewables, or our ability to go out beyond our contract and buy limited renewables, or both? Or how does that scenario play out?
Yep. So in this case, it is both have an impact. For us, we are not any modables acquisitions, but in this case, limited renewables would be our ability to procure renewables would be delayed. We still assume that tier two is available to us and the cost of it is higher because Bonneville is going to have more challenge.
Right.
So we have developed three sensitivities. Oh, I'm sorry. One note on these that I forgot. All of these scenarios and sensitivities are going to assume a level of climate change that include low changes and hydrology changes for the region. Sensitivities. So we're going to run three sensitivities in this case. For the first one, BPA cost change. So as we mentioned, we're now a load following customer. BPA represents somewhere on the order of 80% of our portfolio. And as we transition to load following, that could change. As load following customers, BPA costs represent, they're a big deal for us. We want to test different cost trajectories to see what our portfolio solutions would look like and their impact on us. In this sensitivity, in the BPA cost sensitivity, we're going to vary the BPA prices from the base case and test that to see what happens. In the thin renewable energy credit market scenario, we are a core question within this IRP is regulatory compliance and specifically regulatory compliance strategies regarding state clean energy policies. In this sensitivity, we're going to limit the availability of unbundled RECs, renewable energy credits, and find a strategy to meet our needs from a regulatory compliance perspective. Unbundled RECs are commodities that the district can purchase that are the environmental attributes without the energy associated with it. So there is a developed market for RECs, for different types of RECs, there's different kinds. But in this scenario, we're gonna limit that availability from a wholesale market perspective.
So are these sensitivities applied just to the base case?
Yes, yep. These all live within the base case. And then the final sensitivity is what we want to look at what our resource plan would look like if the Washington State clean energy policies, if CETA becomes the only clean energy policy. Renewable portfolio standard under the EIA or Energy Independence Act requires a certain type of REC from a select type of generating resource, solar, wind, count, incremental hydro count, but traditional hydroelectric does not. In this sensitivity, what we want to do is examine what would happen if we assume that CETA becomes the sole clean energy policy, and we'll evaluate the strategy the district would pursue in that regulatory environment. Questions on these?
Questions, Commissioner?
Okay. So, the final study scope for this IRP, it's been in light of all of what we've done, it's been a really busy year for us. And we're coming here to you for support on the 2025 IRP scope. We'll use the output of these scenarios and sensitivities to develop a resource strategy to remain flexible while keeping electricity affordable and reliable for our customers. We have included the public feedback from public process we did and the tech team process that we used to ensure that our scope development was responsive to the feedback from all of our customers and fellow subject matter experts.
So it sounds like you're looking for a head nod from us on the five scenarios and three sensitivities.
We're looking for feedback and support.
Okay.
Our customers and tech team were telling us that transmission constraints, policy, clean energy and regulatory compliance are all important. So case in point, we have 12 months to complete this. It's going to be it's quite an aggressive scope, but I think we have a plan to get there from where we are today. It appears achievable if we remain on task and dedicated. It's going to be a lot of work, but I think we have a really dedicated team that's capable of getting there. Let's talk about some next steps. We have 11 months, just under 11 months, to come back to you and bring you a 2025 IRP for adoption. Along the way, we're going to have a lot of opportunities to brief you and bring you along as we go through the work. So feel free. This is not the last bite of the apple, as you say in IRP questions. But we do have 12 months to get there. Our next briefing we plan is sometime in Q1, and that'll cover phase two, the load resource balance work that we've been doing.
I have a question for Constance.
Yes, I have a comment and question as well. Thank you for the presentation and for all the work that you do. But again, as I mentioned this morning, do you think that the federal policy going to impact the CETA? And you, in the presentation you mentioned about CETA, so I'm just,
because
I believe that we don't know, right? Yeah. But
yeah, so the primary regulatory constraints that we are looking at are at the state level, CETA and the Climate Commitment Act, CCA. So we're thinking about those as our primary regulatory constraints, but federal policy does impact. So we're going to be looking at federal policy from a cost perspective, right? Tax credits and tariffs could impact resource decisions from a cost perspective. So that's kind of how those show up in our planning. So we'll incorporate those as appropriate within the cost models.
Okay, thank you.
To follow up on your statement, I, based upon my understanding of today's presentation, I have moved forward based upon what's in this presentation. But I do think commissioners would need to be, this is extremely important, very complex. And as we need to firm up our direction early so that we don't get 6 or 8 months into this and decide we don't support it because of all the work that goes into it. So that the earlier we express concerns, the better, I believe.
Well, I'll note that our public engagement process, top priorities were affordability, reliability, which I think are always our priorities, and clean electricity, which is now a law, or already very clean. So I think we've got good alignment with what the public is expecting from us, and what we're working on. And I think the sensitivities are oddly specific, but I think they're fine.
Well, that's the idea of a sensitivity. Yeah, we want to look at one change.
It's interesting. I hadn't thought about the rec market, right? I thought that market would be recs, which we have been plentiful of to dry up. So I had just interesting and thought provoking. Any other follow up questions?
Oh, I echo your comments. So I think this is really important. I agree. So we need to be very proactive as much as we can.
Yeah. Thank you. Like I said, we'll be back in Q1 at some point to talk to you again. Thanks.
Thank you.
Great job, Chris and Harrison. All right, next up is an organized market update, and that's Adam Cornelius. Morning, Adam.
Good morning. Thank you, John. Good morning, commissioners. Clicker's working. So my name is Adam Cornelius. Another kind of presentation here on the wholesale side of things. I'm in the power supply department with Chris and Garrison and Landon. And I've been leading our internal team efforts regarding the development of organized markets. And so this is really about how we engage with and trade with utilities all across the West. We have a team from across the district working on this, but maybe specifically Joe Fina, our senior FERC counsel, is here, and he may be available to answer legal questions, and he's been really involved in this as well. So this is intended as an informational only update and education session. There's no near-term board action recommended, but just like the last one, we'd be really interested in hearing any feedback on kind of where we're at right now. We'll go through some educational background, kind of a wholesale energy markets 101, how we have traditionally traded power and how that could change in the future. We'll talk about a few different ongoing processes and the development specifically of two different day ahead markets. Markets Plus, which is offered by the Southwest Power Pool, and the Extended Day Ahead Market, or EDAM, which is offered by the California Independent System Operator, or CAISO. There's a lot of acronyms. I'll work to spell those out as much as possible. Please interrupt if I fail to do so along the way here. And then we'll also talk about the Bonneville Power Administration, or BPA's Day Ahead Market decision process that we've been involved in. So which market, if any, should they join? After we get to the process stuff, we'll kind of go through a comparison of the two different options out there and then kind of wrap up with an outlook and timeline moving forward. Again, please interrupt with questions. I know you will. If something isn't clear, these are pretty complex topics. A lot to get through, so I may fly through, but stop me if something doesn't make sense. Okay, starting with the background. So really, really high level on the grid, on electric power grid, supply and demand have to be balanced at all times. So utilities trade power with each other in the wholesale market when they have surplus or insufficient power in order to bring their systems into balance or to take advantage of economic opportunities. This is really prevalent and extensive. It happens all the time. There's estimates that I've seen out there of $25 billion of trade across the West on the wholesale electric market. So it's pretty big deal. Historically, that trading in the West outside of California has really been through bilateral transactions. So between individual buyers and sellers, our power scheduling department works with their counterparties and other utilities to buy and sell power as needed with that ultimate objective of balancing our system at the lowest possible cost for our customers. Transactions occur on a lot of different timescales. We have long-term contracts, including with Bonneville Power Administration, various power purchase agreements that can span multiple years, make monthly sales, day-ahead sales, on into real time. And as we get shorter and shorter timescales, we're really honing in on bringing our system in balance in each hour. And then the other kind of consideration that's important here is that to deliver energy from the generator to the load, transmission schedules must be procured from one or more transmission service providers. So we have firm rights on Bonneville system, but if we need to go beyond that, we need to procure transmission schedules on other systems as well.
So this summarizes how we purchase and sell power now.
How we do it now and how kind of historically everything has happened. There's one exception to what we do now, but that's almost all of it. We'll get to that. We engage in the real time, the EIM, and that would be the kind of exception to that. But this is the vast majority of our trade, of Bonneville's trade. So organized wholesale power markets work a little bit differently. Rather than going out and calling up a counterparty, there's a third party called a market operator that provides a platform for everyone, all the resources to submit offers to supply energy and loads to submit bids to buy energy. And then that market operator runs optimization software to identify the least cost set of resources to serve load across that whole footprint, subject to all the constraints in the system, the transmission constraints, making sure that the generators can ramp up and down to meet that solution. But overall, the objective is lowest cost while kind of preserving the reliability, essentially. And the outputs of that software are resource schedules, so what level should each resource operate at, and prices. And those prices can vary across the footprint. It may be more expensive to get to procure energy in a load pocket that's behind a transmission constraint than it is an area where there's a lot of supply resources. Those prices are called locational marginal prices, or LMPs. And you know, relative to the bilateral trading we talked about on the last slide, these organized markets tend to be characterized by greater transparency because of the published prices, more competition, everybody's sort of in the same market together, and greater efficiency. But they do come with some reduced operational control, some level of autonomy that you're giving up to that market operator. And, you know, I would just say that in the, there's most of these markets have two, kind of operate on two different timeframes that work together. There's the day ahead market that's used to set up the operating day based on forecasted activity. And then in the real time market is really used to balance any changes from that day ahead solution. So if the load or the wind forecasts come in differently, there's a change in the real time. And just kind of for a sense of scale, you know, day ahead markets tend to be 10 times or more larger than the real time market activity. So one type of organized market that I talked about on the last slide is there's sort of two different names for what's essentially the same thing: a regional transmission organization, or an RTO, or an independent system operator, or an ISO. A lot of times you'll hear those words used somewhat interchangeably, and for our purposes today, they more or less are serving the same purpose. These, again, are third-party, not-for-profit organizations that run the markets I just described, but they also provide various services to the electric grid. They operate the transmission system. They have the reliability responsibility of what's known as a balancing authority, so that entity that's really responsible in very short-term timeframes to preserve the reliability of the grid and make sure everything is in balance. In some cases, they conduct some of the, or are engaged in some of the long-term planning of resources and transmission in their footprint area. And really the only full RTO or ISO that operates in the West is CAISO. Outside of CAISO, Western utilities have not formed an RTO or ISO, but over the past decade, ISO and another RTO known called the Southwest Power Pool have started offering market-only services to the rest of the West. You see in a lot of the country, they've kind of taken the leap and gone full into these RTOs that provide all those different services. In the West, we've really taken a more incremental approach. outside of the ISO, you know, utilities have continue to primarily trade bilaterally, but over the last 10 years, most, not all, utilities, balancing authorities in the West have opted to join a real-time only market that is operated either by CAISO or SPP. They don't include the day-ahead solution that we talked about a couple slides back, and they don't include that those grid services. One is the Western Energy Imbalance Market, known as the EIM or WEIM, which is an extension of CAISO's real-time market that started, that market started in 2014, and Bonneville joined it in 2022. More in the eastern part of the West, the Western Energy Imbalance Service is a standalone real-time market, that real-time only market that's operated by the Southwest Power Pool, the blue area on that middle map there. And separately, Bonneville and Snohomish are both participating in the Western Resource Adequacy Program, which many view as a critical foundation for day-ahead and real-time markets. So kind of to summarize where we are today, most Western utilities have joined one of these real-time markets where a small fraction of energy is optimized and settled by the market operator. And the vast majority of trading is still bilateral. And the kind of middle column there is the focus, really the focus of the rest of today's presentation. Many utilities, including Bonneville, are working to develop and potentially join the day-ahead market. This will layer on the day-ahead setting up option that has where a lot more trade occurs ahead of the real-time only market. So in that day-ahead market, nearly all energy gets settled and dispatched by the market, but you would expect to still see some bilateral trading. We'll still have long-term power purchase agreements. Utilities will need to procure energy to meet resource adequacy or policy objectives, and also to set up, you know, their position heading into that day-ahead market time. Finally, we'll spend much more time on the RTO ISO, but in the long run, it's possible that one or both day-ahead markets may eventually evolve to becoming a full RTO or ISO. So it's just more kind of worth having that longer run possibility in the back of our minds as we compare the options. So that would be where that market takes on some of those additional grid services.
Can you go back to the previous slide just for a moment?
Yeah, definitely.
So does Bonneville, I know Bonneville participates in the EIM. Do they also participate in the EIS?
They do not. So there's sort of maybe two different ways to think about it. A balancing authority chooses to kind of become a participating member of a market. That doesn't mean that there's no trade that occurs between the markets, but for the purposes of that optimization software within the footprint, that's you're kind of making one choice or the other.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. So this slide is really about, you know, why, you know, given those kind of two different frameworks, a bilateral versus an organized market, and maybe more specifically a day-ahead market, why would utility and maybe Bonneville specifically consider joining a day-ahead market? So we focus on Bonneville because Bonneville is our balancing authority, and as I think I alluded to, it's balancing authorities that make those decisions to join the market. And really because of our, you know, deep relationship with Bonneville on the transmission side, on the power side, we do anticipate that, you know, most of the benefits or risks that might come from BPA joining the market will be conveyed to us. For example, you know, when Bonneville conducts wholesale market activity, that impacts the cost that we pay them for power. So, you know, maybe kind of the core reason for these day-ahead markets is it does provide that greater opportunity for entities to market surplus power and purchase lower cost power when needed. And the optimized trading is a lot more, tends to be a lot more efficient, in part because it's an hourly basis rather than our current bilateral day-ahead trading, which is you have to procure multiple hour blocks. And for hydro resources in particular, buying lower cost power during certain periods, say when there's excess solar power coming up from the south or the southwest, if we can procure that at a low cost, that allows us to store our water and save it for future periods when it's most needed for our own reliability or our load service, or most valuable to the market, the rest of the market as a whole. In general, you get access to greater liquidity and more, you know, buyers and sellers across the footprint of the market than trying to do everything on a one-on-one basis. Reliability side, you know, there's a lot of opportunity for greater coordination with all the neighboring utilities when you are all in this market together. And you also can see benefits on the reliability side from resource and load diversity. And so if there are, you know, if we're in a low water condition or a very high load condition here in the Northwest, we're connected with neighbors in a different, that are kind of in a different physical environment, we would, you know, have better opportunities to bring power in when needed. So that kind of mutual reliability benefit from the coordination and joining into the same market. There's also expected to be greater, more efficient use of the regional transmission system. So, you know, you've likely heard that you know, we have a need to develop a digital transmission. Yeah. The market isn't going to do that for us. But what it does is, particularly compared to current scheduling practices, is that it should make the most out of the transmission that we do have available. And so the market will schedule all the way up to the limits that software has provided in, you know, the most efficient manner possible. Kind of similar to the reliability and the benefits of resource and load diversity are improved integration of renewable energy. And so again, that kind of broad geographic diversity can help decrease the impacts of variable output. Another kind of issue with integrated renewable energy is reacting to forecast errors, and that market software can respond more quickly to forecast errors than individuals trying to schedule around it. So you can get often a better dispatch solution, a better way to move resources up and down to respond to those errors in an organized market. And then the last bullet is really more about maybe the risks of Bonneville not moving to join a day-ahead market if everyone else in the region does. One thing we saw when a number of utilities joined the EIM is liquidity in that real-time timeframe in bilateral world became a lot more scarce. And so it's just harder. There are fewer trading partners. And so, you know, one option could be Bonneville could wait and see what happens. And if everyone else joins a day-ahead market, it may be harder for Bonneville to, you know, do the trading activity that it needs and that really benefits us.
Got a question about the second last bullet.
Yeah.
So as I think about this, we don't know if tomorrow is going to be sunny or windy.
Sure.
How does that work in a day-ahead market, right? The software is choosing the best solution for tomorrow.
Well, so it's really the combination of the day-ahead market and the real-time market kind of working in tandem that provide those benefits in this case. So you're right, there is forecast error that happens in our day-ahead, you know, bilateral markets we engage in today. But I think the day-ahead market can, for example, probably more detailed than the scope we have, but one of the products that both markets are offering in the day-ahead market is a flexible reserve product. And so basically in the day-ahead timeframe, it's assuming you're going to need some sort of, kind of assuming some uncertainty level and procuring some reserves specifically kind of to manage that purpose. It's not specific to renewables, it's kind of the whole scope of possible forecast error. And then those reserves are available, and when you get to real-time, that real-time software can kind of make the best use of those resources to meet what forecast error actually materializes.
So is it then incumbent that the same operator runs both markets, the daytime and the...
Yeah, you would join, any utility would join the same...
Okay.
Yeah, real-time market. So Bonneville, for example, were to choose the Markets Plus option, we'll get into.
Okay.
They would need to leave the energy imbalance.
That's market. Great. Thank you.
That would mean you can't trade with the people on the other market, but you would only be a member of one market at a time. Okay. So there are two, as I've kind of alluded to, market options that are day-ahead market options that are under development in the West. This is kind of a list of all the different utilities that are, you know, maybe leaning in one side or the other, or have participated in the case of Markets Plus in the phase one development. And then in, you know, EDAM is a little bit further along. And so we have entities that have actually signed implementation agreements or have indicated a leaning to join. That's just been a kind of overview of the footprint. And I'll move to sort of the process and the development status. So Markets Plus is wrapping up phase one. The focus of phase one was to really develop the rules of the market. And so there's sort of two types of rules. There's the tariff. These are kind of formal rules and that the market operator and all market participants must operate under, and they have to be filed with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, and approved by FERC. That tariff was filed back in March of last year, and breaking news, the slide says a FERC order was expected last week, and it was approved by FERC. So there's a couple of conditions, but I don't expect those to be a challenge for SPP to meet. And so we'll expect that Markets Plus will move in. Oh, they've also worked on the protocol development, which is what we've been kind of doing as we've been waiting for that order, which are the more detailed technical rules on that don't need to be filed with FERC, but they're important for to really give more detailed guidance on how participants need to engage. And then we'll expect that Markets Plus in the coming months, time frame is a little bit not perfectly clear right now, since we just got this order. But we expect it will move to phase two, which will require additional funding, and we'll really turn to focus on implementation. So we have these rules, and now we need to build the software, communication standards, et cetera, for SPP and market participants and so everyone will need to update their own software, and then all the participating transmission service providers will also need to operate their own their own transmission tariffs. And in many cases, those will require FERC approval as well. EDAM is about a year ahead in the development process of Markets Plus. Their tariff was approved just over a year ago. And they've been, working on their equivalent of the protocol development and implementation activities. And TSPs, transmission service providers, that are planning to join EDAM are currently in the process of updating their own transmission tariffs. And also note that you might have heard of the Westwide Governance Pathways Initiative. We'll get a lot more about this later, but really this is kind of an ongoing effort to increase the independence of the governance for EDAM and the energy imbalance market as well. A proposal has been released, but it will require more participant funding to implement and is subject to legislation in California that hasn't that we haven't seen yet. So turning to Bonneville's data and market decision process, as we mentioned before, it's really the balancing authority who makes decisions to join a market. So this is the kind of decision that's most directly relevant to us. Bonneville is a federal agency, and so for many of its major decisions, just like this one, it's conducting a public process for customers and other stakeholder engagements. And in that process, it's really trying to address two different questions, whether to join a day market, and if so, which one. By the time they wrap up, they'll have had 12 workshops spanning a couple of years. Last year in the spring, their staff issued a preliminary recommendation to pursue participation in day-ahead market. In a day-ahead market with Markets Plus is a preferable option. And they've gotten a lot of interest and engagement from entities all across the region, beyond probably what's their typical customer base, because their position and control over the transmission network in the Northwest is really critical to a lot of other entities and their decisions. And so they've gotten a lot of feedback, and they did end up extending their timeline. And now we're looking at this spring, seeing a draft record of decision in March and a final record of decision in May. Bonneville, BEAs again are the decision maker. Bonneville will be the market participant for the federal system that makes up the bulk of our power supply, and as both falling customers by the time, you know, Audible actually gets into this market, they'll likely be the market business for a little bit as well. So this is a bit of a shift. So today with our product switch, as slice customers, we expected to have a more direct interface with the day ahead market as we currently do with the bilateral market. And more of that kind of direct interface will go to Bonneville. But, you know, talk about how all the benefits and risks that Bonneville faces will flow to us. And so we still have a very strong interest in ensuring that the market works for Bonneville as their costs and benefits, you know, that work for Bonneville and therefore for us. We think that participating in the market development discussions allows us to better understand the impacts as well as to influence market design on behalf of our customers.
So where does this leave us in for phase two? We participated in phase one, are we participating in phase two, or does that not make sense now?
So we funded phase one and participated as a result of that funding. For phase two, I think because of the combination of a few things, there's increased costs associated with phase two. It's about 10 times more expensive than phase one was. We will likely be paying through Bonneville for our share of that. And because of the kind of change in our market position, not looking at this time like we will be funders of phase two. We do intend to continue to engage and participate in you know, whatever way we can, and we will still, all the meetings are public, we'll still be able to engage in the process. And the exact details of how that will work for entities like us are still to be determined.
Any change in that, or any of that make sense? Yeah.
So it's very much up in the air, I would say, exactly what that looks like. So we'll still be involved, but maybe not likely to fund. So we've been, you know, really active in Markets Plus directly. We have a voting member on the executive committee. We are members of multiple workers and task forces. For your question, that could change a little bit. But we also have been working on the EIM and EDAM stakeholder processes. We really know that Bonneville can make a decision in either way, and we want both options to be as good as possible. So we've prioritized trying to engage in both. I will say that on EDAM, a lot of our engagement has been through our trade groups, public generating pool, and the public power council. And of course, we've been involved in Bonneville's day ahead market decision process that's ongoing. Okay, a lot of setup. This is maybe kind of the most substantively interesting part, hopefully, the day-ahead market comparison. So I'd start by saying that at the highest level, you know, the scope and function of the two markets, EDM and Market Plus, is really similar, along the lines of what I talked about in that one-on-one section. They take in bids and offers, they use software to determine the least cost set of resources to serve load in the day-ahead and real-time timeframe. But that software is really a lot more complex than what I just said. And it's in those details that some differences emerge, and some of those differences can really be quite significant. We've been thinking of our comparison across the three, you know, high-level areas you see here. So on governance, this is really the structure and the process that establishes the rules of the market and how they can change. Things like whether participants have voting rights, how new initiatives get started and developed, who has the final say over what gets filed at FERC, and what does oversight over the staff or operating the market look like? How are issues that come up raised and dealt with? Market design, this is the actual rules that govern how the market operator software should work, and how participants are required to act in the market. These rules can have a significant impact on how the costs and revenues of the from the market are allocated between market participants. And so because of that kind of allocation piece, you can imagine there's often some significant disagreements among participants with different positions. And finally, the footprint. So this is really what utilities have decided to join one market or the other. And all else equal, set aside all those other things, you would anticipate that a larger, more connected, and more diverse footprint, the greater the overall economic benefits
but that might vary depending on your individual position within Marble Footprint. And this last one is one of the key drivers of the outcomes that we've seen in the cost-benefit studies, but isn't the full picture in terms of the economic analysis. And you'll see, if you go through this, there are trade-offs among these items. So this slide shows some of the core elements we are thinking about as we evaluate the market options. We've shared similar versions of these considerations with the board in the past, and they really have guided all of our efforts and all these engagements. First two are really governance related. So we want to see a governance structure that's independent of any sector or region, fair representation for all market participants and stakeholders, and a transparent decision-making process. We want to make sure that Snohomish and Bonneville in particular, but everybody really, are able to meet their statutory and contractual obligations. The next four are largely based on market design. So we want, of course, the market should maintain grid reliability. And one piece of that grid reliability is resource adequacy, making sure that there's enough resources, much enough supply in the footprint, not just our own, to keep the market reliable. The market design, you know, given how much we rely on hydropower between our own resources in Bonneville, it's really important that the market design should value that hydropower and all the flexible benefits that it brings to the market. I mean, hydropower can often move up and down really quickly to account for some of that variability. But hydropower also comes with a lot of different non-power constraints. Water supply, both upstream and providing water to, you know, water customers. Ecological fish constraints, all numbers of things that aren't always easily modeled. And so there needs to be, it's really important that our hydro operators, the Bonneville hydro operators, have the ability to operate them in the way that they need to through for their requirements. The transmission framework has to preserve the value of firm transmission rights, and ideally should increase the efficiency of the transmission system utilization, as we talked about earlier. We are, as Washington Utility, we're subject to state policies that, you know, Garrison and Chris talked about earlier, the Clean Energy Transformation Act and the Climate Commitment Act, and so we need to make sure that the market design supports our compliance with those. And finally, you know, this is probably driven by, the last bullet is really driven by probably all three factors, the governance, the market design, and the footprint. But we need to, you know, we need the market to provide economic benefits for our customers relative to the bilateral. So governance, first one. So, you know, just one reason that I think governance is so important to us is that, you know, I mentioned this before, there's this trade-off. We expect to see a bunch of benefits, but we give up some level of our own autonomy, as does every other utility. We all coordinate, work together, and then there's this governance structure over that coordination. And so it's really important that we trust that we have a voice and, you know, fair representation in that governance. So the left column shows some principles. These are sort of a paraphrase from Bonneville's principles. They're really aligned with where we're thinking on this as well. We want to see the market that has a durable, effective, and independent governance structure with fair representation for all of our stakeholders. So Markets Plus, market is overseen by what's called the Markets Plus Independent Panel that's elected by stakeholders, whereas the CAISO Board of Governors, that is kind of the highest body there, is appointed by the California governor. The SPP market operator is fully independent and impartial to market outcomes. They have no particular interest in any region, whereas CAISO is obligated by its statutes to consider previous benefits for California customers first. SPP is not a participating balancing authority within the market, and therefore it's able to facilitate the market without a conflict of interest. CAISO EDM side, CAISO
is a balancing authority for part of the footprint, California, and a market operator for the whole footprint. And it's the potential that that could cause a conflict of interest. The third bullet on the left of the principles is decision-making and stakeholder engagement occurring in a transparent and inclusive manner. So in SPP, you know, all participants really have a voice and a vote in stakeholder processes. TISO does hold public and open stakeholder processes, but what we've seen in the past is that those do tend to be more staff-driven. Finally, there are some special provisions in the Markets Plus tariff that account for the kind of unique situation that federal power administrations like Bonneville, public power like multiple operators have and are kind of unique governance structure. And then that last box really just said, you know, just kind of noting that that potential for fully independent governance was a significant motivating factor for utilities that decided to fund and participate in the development of Market Plus, including ourselves. And, you know, part of that based on some experiences with CAISO where folks felt their voices weren't always heard. So that slide was really about governance as we see it today. But, you know, I want to acknowledge that folks on the, that maybe are more in the CAISO and EDAM camp have put out an effort to really improve the independence of those markets through what's called the West-Wide Governance Pathways Initiative. So this was, this organization or this initiative recently released a step two proposal, which would form what's called a new regional organization, or RO, that's responsible for market policy. So they have, instead of CAISO board having that final authority over market policy, this regional organization would do that policy development work. In order to implement it, it would require California legislative change. And you know, I would just note that similar legislation has failed three times in the past decade. We think that these efforts are really, we appreciate the efforts. It'll be beneficial for all energy market participants in the West to improve the independence of CAISO, regardless of the market decision. But we also don't think that this step two really fully achieves independent governance. CAISO would retain the dual roles of the participant balancing authority for California and the market operator for the full footprint. There's a lot of intertwining between CAISO and that regional organization, including shared staffing and a shared tariff. And really to get to full independence, you'd have to have additional steps beyond this step two that would require additional legislation beyond what's likely to be considered currently and new implementation. So, you know, in our view, it's, you know, there have been calls to pause Markets Plus to see how this plays out. And I don't think that that's reasonable to wait, you know, to pause Markets Plus efforts to wait for uncertain implementation of pathways. If, you know, Markets Plus, that pause results in Markets Plus going away, then that lack of a competing option, market option, might reduce the incentives for folks to implement even the step two of pathways. And, you know, I would just say that Markets Plus governance and its independence is still, you know, maybe the gold standard of what's out there.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it's in my thoughts. I've thought about this a lot. It just seems like it's a good idea, but it's a too late idea. And I'm really concerned about it. You know, if the legislature can change the law one way to help the market, they could potentially change the law in the future. And that's why the truly independent governments, it seems to me to be a lot more attractive. I mean, we've got a lot of years left in the next contract, and we want flexibility that we don't know what's coming next.
Yeah. So all great points that I agree with. So this table has a lot in it over the next two slides. I'm going to kind of get really deep in the weeds. We probably don't have time to get deep into all these weeds. I just want to touch on a couple of these. This is a comparison of the market design. And, you know, really your areas that beyond the kind of high level operation, these are ways in which different rules and processes are different, and we think they're, you know, can be in some cases quite impactful. One I would highlight is the resource adequacy and resource sufficiency. So Markets Plus is designed where everyone participates in the Western Resource Adequacy Program in the requirement, which ensures that utilities will come to the table having done long-term planning with consistent rules in order to come to the market with sufficient supply. EDM does not have that common program. There's might have members that are RAP, members of EDM that are RAP participants. California has its own resource adequacy program. And then you might, there's no specific requirement that a utility in EDM join any resource adequacy program. And so EDM, because of those different standards on a long-term basis, relies on near-term kind of operational timeframe resource efficiency tests, which do help kind of ensure a level playing field in that timeframe, but they're not backed up by that kind of common long-term plan. And so it's really difficult to resolve issues that might arise with that really limited notice. You can't always go out and get new supply in tight conditions when you haven't done that common long-term planning. So Markets Plus really builds on, we've been active and supportive of research, the Western Research Adequacy Program, and Markets Plus really builds on that. And it's consistent with those efforts in the past. Transmission seems, just really quickly, I think the Markets Plus design was designed with interoperability between two markets in mind. And EDM design really poses some challenges for that. I'll leave it there for now. We can get into more if you have questions. Congestion revenue allocation. This is really technical, but basically there's some costs that arise in the market when there are transmission constraints called congestion costs. Those are paid by market participants to the market operator. Those costs have to get reallocated back out to market participants. The Markets Plus design tries to align the allocation of those costs with those who have paid them. So you have an opportunity by investing in transmission rights to hedge against those costs. EDM design leaves it up to each EDM entity to do it differently. And you know, what we've seen so far seems much less likely to enable utilities to use your rights to hedge against those congestion costs you might face. And congestion costs can be really substantial if you are kind of facing bottlenecks between your supply and your demand. Right now, when we buy transmission, that gives us the right to deliver that power at really no additional cost. And you know, ideally, the market design would preserve that for firm transmission rights. And then the last one is greenhouse gas policy support. The pricing design in Markets Plus, really, we designed it to ensure that resources that we've contracted for, and really any utilities contracted for, is appropriately attributed to that utility. And so that reduces the risk of our exposure to greenhouse gas costs within the market and helps ensure that we can use our resources for our CETA compliance. EDM design does some steps along this, but there's a little less degree, there's a little less certainty around how that attribution will work.
Adam, can you interrupt me for a moment?
Please.
John, it's 11:50.
Sorry.
We have a 1 hour executive session and we Zoom at 1:30. So I'm wondering if we should expedite the rest of this. And I'm guilty of asking most of the questions. So all of our meeting, can we expedite the rest of this? And then can we postpone the following presentation to either the next meeting or this afternoon? We also have an executive session this afternoon, which will probably be a lengthy.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking about, can we postpone the next one out of this morning and figure out maybe before the afternoon? I just think, I'm worried the commissioners won't have a chance to get lunch.
Yeah.
Or even maybe finish the executive session.
Timing on the transmission and revenue adjustment presentation.
It can be pretty quick, but we're trying to set up a sequential process so that we can move through as many as 10 contracts later. So it'd be important for the commission to hear.
But is it necessary for today, or could it be pushed to the next meeting?
We could push it to the next meeting.
but it seems
it might be my recommendation. No more. It's 10 minutes.
It, we can and still meet the timeline.
We can.
The presentation. Our cybersecurity executive session, there's no time required to pay for that. If you want to, commissioners, if you want to push that one out.
I'm sorry. I could.
Yeah, she's suggesting that we move our cybersecurity executive session to a later date.
We can also move some of the 101 presentations as well and drag those into another meeting.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's do that. Let's
move the executive this afternoon's executive session to another meeting.
Yeah.
And then come back this afternoon with
the transcription
of the trilogy of the dreams.
Yes.
So then, now. Executive session.
Yeah.
Now,
are
we take
as soon as this presentation, yeah.
Okay.
And then we come back. John's session, piece, and the rest of this.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not very good, but you got it.
Okay.
All right. I think I got my message. Let's move through this quickly. There's a lot of words on this slide. So this is really the third option, the third element, the footprint, and how it relates to the cost-benefit studies. So Bonneville has conducted a number of cost-benefit studies of the sort of status quo versus the Markets Plus option versus the EDAM option across a variety of different market footprints and scenarios. I think the kind of key results, there's likely financial benefits from joining either day-ahead market. But that EDAM looks like it would provide higher economic benefits than Markets Plus based on largely the footprint of the utilities that are leaning in one direction or the other. That difference is, on the order of $50 to $100 million a year. Our scale of that is maybe about 10% typically. I think that the very high end of that is not super likely, and for a couple of reasons. It's really based on a very limited trade between the two footprints that I don't think is likely. We would anticipate trade to continue. Everyone would be incentivized to reduce the seams and the cost of trading across the two markets. And so we anticipate that it's just within the scope of the production cost study. It's likely to be on the lower end of that range. That's one thing. And the second is that the production cost studies do not tell the whole picture. that there are, all those market design elements that we just talked about that we think are beneficial on Markets Plus side are difficult to quantify and do not show up in those production cost studies. We think those can significantly impact the allocation of benefits and are likely to offset a lot of those that kind of production cost study difference. It also doesn't account for any qualitative factors such as governance that really can shape the future rules and kind of risks in extreme situations.
Yes.
I just want to make sure I heard correctly. The range of the cost for the study. Did you say that Snohomish itself was 10%?
So typically, I think with Bonneville, we're about 10% of Bonneville's load. So a good order, kind of rule of thumb when you look at those types of costs. It's hard to say exactly what share, Bonneville or Snohomish would face.
But we're not talking about cost from benefits.
Correct. So it's a difference in benefits.
Benefits.
This is not the study.
So the study is just the
results of the study.
The results of the study, they're called production cost studies. They really show benefits for both markets and a difference in benefits on that order. Right.
Thank you for
clarifying
that.
Sorry.
I was saying, first, and keep my eye, okay.
Thank you. That study range is that the Bonneville scale, our scale is significantly smaller. So, the takeaways, I think, from all of this
all this comparison, the governance and market design considerations really support Markets Plus. Production cost study based on the footprint differences really supports eNAM. Markets Plus provides much greater certainty on independent governance, while eNAM leaves a lot to future processes. I think our analysis is pretty consistent with Bonneville's to date. We think they're conducting a good process. We continue to engage in it. I would say that Public Power Council has also supported Bonneville's continued engagement in Markets Plus, really to preserve the optionality of that market decision. And I would just say that the presence of Markets Plus has had positive impact on the EDM side in terms of the governance and the market design. We talked about pathways likely arising because Markets Plus exists. There's some other kind of detailed market design things where you've seen that as well. So, things are still very fluid. Entities are making decisions. A lot of outcomes are still not within our control. We'll continue to engage in all of the processes. That's our plan, is to take those market considerations we talked about and continue participating in Markets Plus, in EDAM, and in Bonneville's process. And we'll keep you all informed of significant developments, as appropriate. So. There's a timeline slide, but probably this is maybe more for reference than to talk through.
Yeah, I think the thing to note is that they're going to make their draft record decision in 2 months. Maybe before the legislature does anything.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry for the extra time I took there.
No, thank you. You're good.
Just one really quick note. Adam and Joe Pina have both been just phenomenal players in this whole area of markets. They're both considered experts and have really not only had us given us a seat at the table, but really had a lot of influence on how the SP Markets Plus has gone. So huge kudos to them. Yeah. Great job on the presentation, Adam.
Thanks.
And this is huge for us.
That's
enormous. So
big deal.
Thank you all. Okay. So when we return at 1:30, we'll resume with item 8.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it is now 11:59, and the board will recess into executive session to discuss performance of a public employee under the terms set forth in the Open Public Meeting Act. Anticipated the executive session will last approximately 60 minutes and conclude at 1 p.m. The regular meeting will reconvene here in the commission meeting room at 1:30 p.m. Now 1:01 p.m. and we'll be extending for approximately 10 minutes and we'll conclude at 1:11 p.m.